Today's Taisho will be on case 63 in the Haikigan Roku in the Blue Rock Collection. Nansen cuts the cat in two. Engo's introduction. What is beyond thinking must be the topic for serious discourse. What transcends words should be the subject of earnest investigation. When lightning flashes and shooting stars fall, you should display the power to drain the deepest lakes and overturn the mountains. Have any of us acquired such ability? See the following. Main subject. Nansen one day saw the monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and said, "If you can give an answer, I will not kill it." No one could answer. Nansen cut the cat in two. Secho's verse. Thoughtless, the monks of both halls, raising dust and smoke out of control. Fortunately, Nansen was there. His deeds squared with his words, he cut the cat in two, regardless of who was right, who was wrong. I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning on this beautiful spring day. I hope you can all hear me. I have allergies and haven't really had this problem until the last couple of years. But for the last couple of years I've had these allergies, and then they turn into like bronchitis. And it all happens rather fast. So I was down in Southern Virginia last weekend, and they're about 3 weeks ahead of us, and I could feel my lungs getting tighter and tighter each day that I was down there. The pollen was sort of like blowing through the air. You could almost see it. And so when I came back up here, it's that we're just starting. So this is just the way it goes, right? I was unable to sleep the other night because of the allergies, you know, and it just seemed like every molecule in my body was irritated. I was lying in bed and I was coughing and coughing and coughing. And then I finally drifted off to sleep, and I got up maybe, I woke up maybe 2:30, something like that. And I got out of bed and I was sort of bleary headed, you know, and coughing and just irritated, I don't know. And then I heard, I was sitting in the bedroom and I heard this screech owl. We have a screech owl in our neighborhood. Screech owls do sometimes screech. But rarely, as a matter of fact. They purr. They go, they're so cute, you know. They're only about like 8 inches tall, 6 to 8 inches tall. They're little tiny owls. And there's some who live in our neighborhood, and this owl must have been in the maple tree right next to the window. And he was going, rrr, rrr. It's just this gentle little sound. You know, if I were a mouse, it would fill me with terror. You know? But for a human, it's very beautiful. And so I heard this owl, you know, and for a minute, or for a little while, really, it was like all my discomfort just disappeared. And I felt so alive, you know, just felt so alive. that's, you know, who would, some of you may have allergies, you know. Would you really trade spring, you know, to get rid of your allergies? There's something about spring, I think, that's worth the allergies. You know what I mean? It's just worth it. And I have to tell you, you know, I'm going to be, I'll have bronchitis till next session, probably. But honestly, I think it's worth it to have spring. And for just that, you know, I got up, was really annoyed, you know, naturally, like everybody else, I like to sleep soundly. I just wasn't sleeping soundly. I was having like crazy dreams. My wife told me the next day that I was talking in my sleep, which is something I never do. And she said, I said, well, what was I saying? And she said, you know, it was just gibberish. You know? But so it's sort of like a fever dream, you know. And I got out of this fever dream and it was just like every molecule was annoyed and irritated. You know? If you have hay fever, you know what that's like. And I couldn't breathe, couldn't get... And then I heard the screech owl and I was like, oh, and I'm so glad to be alive. And so beautiful. This koan is very troubling, you know, if you are literal-minded about it. There was a monastery, and a Nansen, Master Nansen was the teacher of Joshu. Nansen is a, as those of you who speak Chinese know, I can't even pronounce Chinese words, but Nansen is Nanchuan, right? And Joshu is Zhaozhou, right? Zhaozhou, the great Zhaozhou. Okay. So Nansen is in the temple, and his temple is a typical place, typical temple. If you go to a temple anywhere in East Asia, a Zen temple or a Chan temple, you will find some enlightened people, some people who are deeply awake, and many people who are deeply confused. And they're at the temple, so they can move from being deeply confused to deeply awake. But generally speaking, the majority are deeply confused. So temples are usually not like wonderful places. They're full. They're like if you're in the academic world, they're like your department, you know? Okay? Or if you're in the business world, they're like your office, right? You know. So there's all kinds of human jealousies and rivalries and aggression and so on. It's all under the surface. You know? And but people who come to these places have said, you know, I realize I have some problems. I want to clear up my karma and wake up. So that's really good. So they're there. And it's a good, they're on the right road, in my opinion. But they're not there yet. So at this temple, humans being humans, they find ways to have arguments with one another and to be unhappy. And in this case, it involves a cat. So there's two wings to the temple. There's a east wing and a west wing. And a little cat, an innocent little cat, walks into this human drama. And basically, monks in the east wing see the cat. And even though it's against the rules for monks to own a cat, they adopt the cat. And they feed it and love it, you know, take care of it. But, you know, it's a cat, right? So it's not going to stay in the east wing. It's going to go to the west wing, being a cat. And I'm somebody who loves cats. You know, but you can't put a cat here and say, stay here, right? That's never going to happen. So the cat goes over to from the east wing to the west wing. And the people in the west wing say, oh, this is a lovely kitty. Why don't we feed it? In fact, we can take better care of it than the people in the east wing. We can do much better job than those bozos over there. Right? So, you know, they maybe bring the kitty milk, or maybe even though they're not supposed to have meat, you know, maybe they bring the kitty some chicken. You know? And then the people in the East Wing hear about this and say, did you hear what they've done? You know, they're bribing that cat. They're trying to, you know. So this goes on, right? And each wing is a rival for the cat, and maybe East Wing sends over like a contingent at night and kidnaps the cat back to the East Wing. And then the West Wing hears about that. It's like, that just confirms my suspicions about those people. You know? So this is a human drama, right? And finally, nobody is making any progress in their Zen practice, in their Chan practice. People are sitting on the cushion thinking, I'll get the kitty a bell, you know? And somebody else is sitting there thinking, those bums, you know, they're giving the kitty, if they think they can bribe that cat with rice, wait till I get those fish, you know? So this is going on all the time. And it's in the way of people's waking up. It's like a hostile atmosphere. On one side of the meditation hall are the East Wingers, and on the other side, the West Wingers, right? This is like Hutu and Tutsi, you know, Tamil and Sinhalese, you name it, Palestinian, Israel. It's human drama. And the innocent little cat is caught up in this. So Nansen comes in one day and he says, I've just had it. I've really had it. You people are just digging yourselves deeper and deeper into illusion. You know, here's the kitty and here's the kitchen knife, right? I want to hear one person say one thing that comes out of awakened mind, or I'm going to cut this cat in two. And he's just waiting for anybody to say anything that shows an undivided mind. Undivided mind. No one can do it. They're all silent. And then Nansen does the unthinkable. He cuts this innocent little cat in two. This is, I hope if you practice long enough, we'll have a chance to do this koan together. It's quite upsetting, you know, especially if you're a cat fan, as I am. So cuts the cat in two. There's other versions of this. There's a version of this in the Mumonkan, but this version just ends with that. So. Now, you know, this is an upsetting event because, first of all, Nansen is supposed to be the embodiment of compassion, and by all accounts, he was. He was a deeply awakened, deeply compassionate person. One of the greatest Zen masters in the late Tang Dynasty China. This would be like the Dalai Lama running over a cat with his car, you know. It would be so shocking. People wouldn't know what to make of it. What, the Dalai Lama ran over a cat? Ran over a... I can't believe it. So this koan is a lot to handle. Very difficult, very advanced koan. It's easy to get very mad at Nansen. And indeed, what he did was a violation of every rule that monks and nuns take. And one of the first vows you take is not to kill. In fact, the first vow you take, if you're ordained, is not to kill anything, ever. So he broke his first rule as a monk. And of course, it's totally inconsistent with compassion, right, to kill anything. So this is like a baffling koan, very difficult to deal with. Now, you know, one way to deal with it is to try to figure it out intellectually. So you could make a case that this was just a terrible mistake. You could say this violates all of the precepts that the Buddha laid down. You know, this is clearly an example of a monk who's made a terrible misjudgment. Or you could say, well, Nansen realized he had to do something. It was an emergency, and he was willing to take the bad karma on his shoulders in order to help others. So it was like a bodhisattva's act of generosity. So those are just intellectual encounters with the koan, and they're not really very useful. Now, to work with a koan like this, you have to be in deep mushin, deep ushin, deep shunyata for a long time, And on your out-breath, you say, cuts the cat, cuts the cat, cuts the cat, or kills the cat, so cuts the cat, or cuts the cat in two, cuts the cat in two, cuts the cat in two. And it's possible to get very upset about what Nansen has done, but when you work with the koan, try not to form any judgments about it. I was reading something the other day in a magazine I occasionally pick up at the newsstand, Backpacker Magazine. And there was an interesting article in Backpacker Magazine, or I thought it was interesting anyway. Does this ever happen to you? You're trying to find something in a book and you can't find it, it mysteriously disappeared. There's a woman whose name you may not have heard of, I've never heard of her. Her name is Renata Chlumska. Renata Chlumska. She is like a rather well-known person in outdoor adventuring circles. And she was involved romantically with a person whose name was Jörn Krop. They met in Sweden. She's also from Scandinavia. And Jörn Krop was a famous outdoorsman and adventurer. He's the kind of guy who, let's see. He bicycled from Stockholm to Nepal. Okay. He climbed Everest without supplemental oxygen, and then he pedaled home, back to Stockholm. Okay. And he was immortalized. If any of you have ever read anything by John Krakauer, his book Into Thin Air, he was immortalized. Jörn Krop was immortalized in that book. So he's the kind of guy who climbs up Everest without any oxygen, right? And makes it down alive and bicycles back to Scandinavia. And she too does those kinds of crazy things, right? So it's a sort of compatibility factor here, right? They met in really? You bicycled to Nepal? You know, that's great. You know, I bicycled to Mexico once, you know? And really? What kind of bicycle, you know? So what do you know, they fell in love and they started living together. And they had big plans. They were going to go on a number of adventures like that, you know. And they were forming a plan actually to go around the entire continental United States by bicycle and kayak. It sounds crazy, right? But that's what they decided to do. They were going to kayak wherever they could kayak, and then bicycle wherever they couldn't kayak. And they were going to do the whole circle of the United States, which is like 3,000 miles or something like that, 2,800 miles. And they were getting sponsors. Of course, this is the modern world, so you have to get sponsors. And they were having special bicycles made that had you know, carts on the back that would carry the kayak and so on. So she was going up Mount Everest, and while she was there, she got a phone call, somebody told her that Jörn Krop, the person she loved and lived with, had fallen to his death outside of Seattle. He was climbing a place I've never been to called Frenchman Coulee, which is a coulee is a geological formation. It's like very sheer cliff, and it wasn't that high cliff, and it wasn't that hard a climb. But you know, he just had a bad day, and he fell and died 75 feet. So, anyway, the story is about what she decided to do after that. And what she decided to do was go the whole thing herself, you know, just take off. She went ahead with the expedition. And the article is sort of covering her progress on this expedition. And she, it starts out, and they're talking about her going up this very steep incline as she's moving from western Washington to eastern Washington across the state, which is basically a big desert. Central Washington is like this big desert, and you gain altitude after you go over the Olympic Mountains and cross the Columbia River. And it's just this very dry, barren stretch uphill almost all the way into all the way to Montana, pretty much. And they're talking about the article talks about her pedaling her bicycle, which is pulling a kayak up this very difficult stretch near the Columbia River. And her sweat and so on, and she does. She's just determined to do this, right? She goes around. Apparently, goes around the whole country, and as she's doing this, you know, basically people, some people ride with her. They come on their bicycles or they kayak with her, and she sleeps in a tent. And you know, there's a lot of debate about what kind of an expedition is this. This is kind of crazy, right? It would be like. You know, she took her kayak by New York City, you know, so she's going through the Hudson. You know, that you think, what kind of an adventure is that, you know? In a certain way, this doesn't make any sense, right? It's almost crazy. It's not like taking your sled dogs across the Arctic, right? She's bicycling by McDonald's and so on. But she feels that it's very much something she has to do after the death of her boyfriend, you know. And the article is sort of just posing the question, what's this all about? Or you know, why is she doing this? And she doesn't talk about it. She just says, this is something I have to do. And I really liked this article because I thought to myself, you know, she's faced something that must have hurt her very much, right? This is probably the man she wanted to marry and make her life with. You know, she might have had all kinds of plans. Maybe they would have had children. You know, they would have gone up other, I don't know, there's no higher mountain than Everest, but they could have found some other mountains to climb together. I'm sure she had a lot of those kinds of dreams. And then he was dead, you know, on a climb that should have been a cakewalk for him. You know, I think when those kinds of events happen to us, it's a little bit, don't you think, it's a little bit like being cut in two, yeah? It's like you're just cut in two. Nobody likes to be cut in two. Yeah? It hurts. And the world is really changed when you're cut in two. So one way to think about the koan is that it's about a little cat, innocent little cat. But you know, there's a hint here, and that is, in a certain way, we're all an innocent little cat. You know, we're all the innocent little cat. And life often cuts us in two. And it really hurts, yeah? So this koan is sort of getting at that experience. Yeah. But I thought that Renata's response was a really good response, you know, because she could have gone back to, actually she was living in Seattle, they had moved to Seattle, and she could have gone back to Seattle and gotten depressed and, you know, very bitter, but instead she went ahead with their plan and she's just pumping her bicycle up this insane slope, and the sweat is popping out her forehead and so on. And it, you know, I think this is very much like a zazen. You know, the writer of this article didn't really have words to describe what she was doing. You know, nobody likes to be cut in two, but when you're cut in two, you can respond in a lot of different ways. And one of them is Renata's way, you know, which seems to make no sense if you don't kind of have a word for it. And the word I'd like to suggest is, it's actually two words, is self-overcoming. Yeah? Self-overcoming. And I think self-overcoming is tremendously important when you're cut in two. Yeah? Because we live in a little self, yeah? And we have to live there. It's our home. You know, we all have a name, and we have memories, and we have associations, and we call this ourselves. And you need a self. You should have a self. You know, and you should have a self you enjoy living with. You know? But sometimes life deals us an event or a blow, a cut, and you know, it can seem like unbearable pain or unbearable difficulty. And then you think, well, what's the way out of this? What's the way out? And Renata's way is also like the Zen way. The Zen way is like self-overcoming. When we sit on the cushion, you know, it's not like facing death, right? Literally, you're not going to die if your legs hurt a little bit. But some of you might have had a very difficult week, and you came in here to sit, and you sat on the cushion, and you know, you suddenly realize, wow, I'm really tired today. Or, you know, you may have envisioned that you were going to come in here and sit down on the cushion and have this blissful sit, a beautiful sit. And about two sits into all of this, your left knee really begins to hurt. Yeah? Or your back, small of your back, really begins to hurt. And, you know, what if you practice Zen long enough, you don't let that get you down. You realize that you can do something about that experience. So you focus, you use the hara, use your dantian, and you squeeze the breath out, and it goes out, 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 out. You see it? If you focus your attention on the breath and not on your pain, you're only intermittently aware of the pain. Yeah? So it's like you focus on the breath, and the breath goes out, 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 until your mind becomes blank and dark. And then a pain sensation arises, and then you do that again. Yeah, and you do that again. And again, if you've just started practicing Zen, after, say, 10 or 15 minutes of this, your mind might become very tired. And you may need to move because you just can't maintain the concentration anymore. But if you have been practicing Zen for a while, you keep doing that. Little by little, you push your pain far away. Or another way to put it is you dissolve the pain. And at some point, you find yourself sitting in this extraordinary stillness. It's just extraordinary. It's like imperturbable calm, unshakable stillness. Yeah? And usually in that state, which is accompanied by like blank mind, there's at some point there's going to be this surge of life energy. It's as though you're, you know, we all go through this in Zen training, you know. There's some sits where you're, you know, basically, just to put it in a vulgar way, it's like, you know the saying, it kicked in the ass. It really kicked my ass today, you know. That really kicked my ass, you know. I like that. It's like complete defeat, right? Wow. So we all have those sits where Zen sort of just kicks us in the ass, you know. It's like, I went down in flames, you know. I went down in flames, and that's it. here, and you just break the sit, and you put your head in your lap and think, okay, I'm sending up the white flag, you know? And everybody's done that. But the interesting thing is that after that, there's an after that, you know? If you come back to the cushion and you try again, sooner or later you're going to get to this place that is indestructible and imperturbable. Right? It's the Buddha called it the deathless. Yeah? The deathless. And at first you taste it just a little bit, you know? You're sitting on the cushion and suddenly your mind just goes blank and still, and there's just nothing there. And it's like that, it's gone. But eventually, you know, you're in pain and you're sitting there thinking, you know, oh, boy, that knee, it's really killing me, you know. Now, whatever you do, don't visualize your knee, right? That's a big mistake. Focus on the breath, and the breath takes you out to blank mind, right, to empty mind. And if you stay in empty mind long enough, there's going to be like this energy, this surge of life energy. And it's... You know, you're like a wet, limp cloth, right? Just hanging on your skeleton. And it's like somebody walks over and puts a plug in the wall and the electricity starts flowing. And it just goes through your whole body, right? And it's like, ah, you know, this is it. This is it. You know, I have had my ass kicked thousands of times by Zen, you know? I have been dead on my cushion thousands of times in Zen. But if you just hang in there, if you just keep watching the breath, that plug, somebody plugs that in, you know, and it's like zzz, it's like the sun comes on in your head, you know, and it's so great to be alive, right? This is self-overcoming. It's the essence of our, one way to think about it, is the essence of our practice. Nobody likes to die, you know. Nobody likes to be a wet rag, you know, hanging on his bones on the cushion. But, you know, if you just don't, you just come back to the cushion, sooner or later that energy is going to flow. And then, like I say, it's like the sun coming out in your head. It's the most beautiful thing in the world. It's absolutely deathless. Yeah. Now, you know, we don't all follow the path of Zen. Some people follow the path of a bicycle and kayak, you know, around the United States. And Renata Schlumska has decided to do that. Now, I have never heard of anybody having a Kensho on a bicycle. I really don't think it's possible. At least what we call Dai Kensho, I don't think that can be possible. But people do have a kind of a small Kensho experience in athletic events where they're in deep samadhi and they begin to feel very connected to things. And I think this is, she knows this from her athletic life, you know. She knows that if she just pedals hard enough and she keeps going, there's going to be a moment where everything drops away and she just feels totally connected to the world. Yeah? And that's liberation. That's self-overcoming. Very beautiful. You know, this last weekend, I was down in Southern Virginia because my mother died. My mother has had Alzheimer's disease for the last 4 years. And it was difficult for her, as you can imagine. And we weren't happy to see her go into a decline. Also, it turns out that she had undiagnosed ovarian cancer, and we didn't really know it until about a month ago. And indeed, she died of undiagnosed ovarian cancer. My mother was probably the person on this earth I was closest to. She was a really nice person. I wrote her obituary and put it in the paper. And a lot of people who came to the funeral complimented me on what a good writer I am. I was happy to hear that. But the obituary was really good because I talked, most people I think try to talk about, you know, present kind of an ideal image, and I just talked about my mother's life. It was like social history. And my mother grew up in upstate New York, and she had like one pair of shoes a year. My grandfather was a dairy farmer in the worst place in the world to have cows, right? It's like a minus 40 degrees up there in the winter. And they were living the very spare life in the middle of the Great Depression. So like my mother said that when my grandfather would go to town, he'd bring a candy bar back and the whole family would share one candy bar. You know, that kind of thing. But my mother got through high school, which was a major achievement in her family. And she worked as a court reporter. She became a court reporter and what we would now call like paralegal. And she wanted to go to law school, but she didn't have the chance. Later in her life, she was like an administrative assistant for a lot of different, some different companies and the state of Virginia. Grew up in a house where there were like no books except for the Bible. You know? But when I was a little boy, my mother used to, actually this is true, my mother actually used to read like philosophy. She read Marcus Aurelius when I was a little boy. And she was so troubled by the Holocaust that she read, when I was a little boy, I remember her reading these books by this guy named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a theologian who was writing about, who was killed by Hitler. So she was kind of a remarkable person, and I think I owe her a lot, pretty much everything. Yeah. So I probably talked to my mother once every 2 or 3 weeks for maybe 20 years. And we had some really great conversations. When I went to the funeral, my mother wanted a conventional funeral. My sister knew a minister who she likes. He's a nice guy. And so it took place at a Lutheran church outside of Williamsburg, Virginia. And when I went to the funeral, the minister, who was a very nice man, he greeted me and he took me by the hand. He said, "This must be a very, very bad day for you, a very difficult day." I said, "No, it's not. It's really not." And I said, "You know, there's really nothing to worry about." He was very happy with that answer. Mm. He has beliefs, and he believes, of course, that you know, when you die, you go to heaven. And my mother lived like an exemplary life, so. You know, by the terms of her religion, she should definitely be in heaven. Now, I personally don't believe in heaven in the conventional way, but it still doesn't bother me, honestly, that my mother died. It can bother you if you look at life in a certain way. You know? When we live in a certain mindset, these transitions are very difficult, right? They're very difficult. It's painful to lose somebody you love. It's just painful, right? If you live a certain way, you know. And indeed, you know, I have been to so many funerals in my time, and I have been always rather saddened by the sort of abject grief that people go through, you know, and I'm not criticizing them, but it's just they're just really like shaken to their roots by this experience. And I just don't think that It has to be like that, you know. When my father was dying, you know, he had lung cancer, and I was with him when he died for maybe 3 or 4 days. This was maybe 15 years ago. And I would just get up every morning and do Zazen. And it was so helpful to me to be with my father, and be able to assist him, and be able to show him that I loved him, sort of in an unqualified way, you know. I think it was very helpful to him. And, you know, when my father died, I had the strangest reaction, because, you know, having grown up in a society where people are just like abjectly bowled over by death, I was waiting for like these waves of grief to wash over me, you know. But it just didn't happen. You know, my father had a morphine drip because his lungs were filling up with fluid. This is actually how my mom died, too. You know, after a while, you just can't breathe anymore, and then you just asphyxiate and you die. But my father was very lucid, and I was with him right up until the end, you know. And then he was dead, and I was just waiting for like this. I thought, maybe I'm blocking, you know, maybe I'm blocking. But I was waiting for these waves of grief to come, but it just didn't happen. And I got up and I walked outside into the fields, and everything was so alive. It was so beautiful and bright, and my heart felt so clear and clean. And by the way, I loved my father, you know. But I don't know what to say, except that it wasn't, it just was, the waves of grief just didn't happen. And, you know, I just felt so alive. I'm so grateful to be alive. And the same thing happened with my mom. You know, I was with her, fortunately, not just when she died. My sister and I stayed with her from about 4:30 in the afternoon until about 2:30 at night. And we went to sleep because we just couldn't stay up anymore, and then we got a call from the nursing home that said, you better come back. And we came into the room, and she wasn't breathing, and she just died maybe 15 minutes ago, something like that, because her hands were still warm. And, you know, I sat down and I could remember that this was somebody who, you know, my mother used to read me books when I was a little kid. And she read me books that I loved, like she read me Bambi, you know, I loved Bambi. She read Wizard of Oz. She was a very kind person and very patient, and really like an excellent mother, in my opinion. When she was gone, there was a part of me that, you know, I have to tell you the truth. I just felt this great stillness, and then, you know, I went outside, and everything was so alive. And, you know, I felt a little, both times I felt like a little guilty, like I ought to be miserable. But I just think maybe that's false in a certain way. You know, I had good relations with my mom. You know, there were no, like, unresolved issues. You know, I loved her, she loved me, and we loved to be together and to talk on the phone. And my father and I had a lot of conflicts, but, you know, that's the way it goes. I think maybe we're enculturated to see death as this terrible event, but I really don't think it is. You know, my sister's nephew, his name is Tyler, we came home after my mother had died, and he's 5 years old, and he's like an incredible bundle of energy. And he wants to play all the time, and he likes me, and he wants me to play with him all the time. And it gets to be so tiring, I actually get exhausted after a while. He wanted me to play with him, and I played with him for like half an hour, and then he wanted, you know, if you're 5 years old, if you chase somebody around the house, it's not just interesting the first time, it's interesting every time you do it. Right? So you can do it like infinite numbers of times until you have to go to bed, you know. And then you can do it in the morning again, right? Whatever you do, he said, don't tickle me, you know. Whatever you do, don't tickle me, you know, okay. So anyway, it was interesting because at one point, as evening was coming on, he started to talk about Grammy, his Grammy being gone, and it was like he couldn't decide if he should start crying or not. It was like he was crying a little bit, and then he was looking at me like he wanted me to chase him, and then he was crying. And I know he loved his grandmother, but you know, I'm not sure he knew what to do about this event. It was like he was looking for clues, like how am I supposed to behave at this? When I was about his age and my grandfather died, you know, people just were like abjectly bowled over by my aunt and my mother, you know, just like the hankies were, you know, drenched. And like this was an unspeakable calamity. You know, so I'm not sure that we have to deal with it that way, you know. I think that we're like waves on the ocean, you know. It's just like a wave on the ocean. We're here, and you know, we're somebody for a while. Kurt, my mother's name was Joyce, my father's name was Lawrence. You know, we're Kurt, or we're Joyce, or we're Lawrence. And we're, you know, distinctive, like a wave. Wave is the individual element of the ocean, right? It has a personality, it has a shape and a form. It's moving in a certain direction. You know, it comes into being and then it goes away. But it's never not the ocean. It's never not the ocean. You know, and going back to the ocean is not like this great tragedy. I think death seems so scary to people because we live in a small mind so much that we have little areas of contact with life, you know, little tiny moments of contact. And then, you know, a lot of the time it's just sort of like a dead world, you know. And so if you lose, you know, somebody you love, you know, it's like your world has become more dead. And it's a tragedy, it's a calamity, it's a dark, you know, like, this is terrible. But I think that if you, you know, you sit on the cushion 10,000 times, and it's not unrealistic, right? Really. You sit on the cushion 10,000 times, and I think you have a different experience of life, you know. You don't spend so much time in a small cell. You spend a lot of time playing in the ocean. And it's easier to be a wave if you spend a lot of time being the ocean. You know what I mean? It's easy to be a wave if you know you're the ocean. You know, if you spend time in as the ocean. You know, when I go to my office, I'm Kurt, you know, or Professor Spellmeyer or whatever, you know. But when I sit on the cushion, I'm not Kurt, I'm the ocean. I really am. It's like, Kurt is like this little thing out there, you know? And it's so alive. It's just like so wonderful. And it's okay to be Kurt, you know? It's just small. But when you sit on the cushion, sooner or later you're gonna be the ocean, not just the wave. And it's great, right? And you realize this is a deathless world. It's not deathless because we go to heaven. It's deathless because this is heaven. This is heaven, you know. So you know, basically, it's just heaven to heaven to heaven to heaven to heaven. Now, you know, when your legs hurt, it might feel like hell, right? But you just have to be in hell long enough to get out of your little self and go back to the ocean. And then it's just heaven. Even if your legs hurt, it's heaven. So help me. So I just couldn't say to the minister, he said, well, this must be a very dark day to you. I couldn't do it. You know, a convention would say, yes, you know, it's very dark. I couldn't do it.
And I wasn't giving him a hard time. In fact, he very much appreciated what I said. I just said, no, it's not. It's a beautiful day. My mother lived a wonderful life, full of many challenges. She was 80 years old. You know, she had three children who loved her. And every day she got up and she sat in this beautiful world and smelled the spring flowers, and she had her kitty, and so on and so on. It's not a tragedy to die. It's just a change of form. We do it all the time. Really and truly, really. And I don't think that takes anything away. I think it just makes this world all the more wonderful. So, it's conventional to say, I'm so sorry for your loss, right? And please, it's not a loss. It's never a loss. It's never a loss. It's just, this world is infinitely alive. It's just, you open this door, and it's alive. You open this door, and it's alive. You open this door, and it's alive. There isn't really such a thing as a calamity. That's just little mind thinking. So listen, when the world cuts you in two, don't be afraid. Conventionally speaking, the worst thing that can happen to people is to die, right? And it's not at all bad. You can say, well, you haven't died yet. Okay, so stick around. We'll see how it goes, right? But it's guaranteed, right? And you might as well be happy about it, right? You can be miserable or you can be happy. Which do you want to be? Right? So one way to think about Zen is this is about being happy with whatever life offers. This is like, I'm so grateful for my life. I'm so grateful for my mother's life. I'm so grateful to have known my father. I'm so grateful to have known my brother. This is not a tragedy. Everything is here just for a little while. It's a wave on the ocean. This is a beautiful ocean, a wonderful ocean. There is no loss. There is no loss. Okay? So after the sit, please don't say, I'm sorry for your loss. Okay? I love everybody in this room, but you don't have to say that, because I don't think it's a loss. It's a beautiful day. Life is indestructible. We're crazy. We have a crazy leader. We can blow this place to smithereens, right? But actually, life is indestructible. Infinitely beautiful. Infinitely wonderful. And today, we came to swim in the ocean, which is our true home, in the deathless. So, thank you.